for it is impossible, he had said, to think of that lady in any low place, any place of darkness, the barred charnel house of purgatory, with its flying cinders and sulphur reek, its boiling tar and roiling clouds of sleet. Alice, he says, dry your tears. Find Thomas Rotherham and end his pain. You need not come to Lambeth tomorrow. Jo can come, if she is as formidable as you say. Alice turns in the doorway.
I will see her again, though, Eliza Barton. I should like to see her before
they kill her. Alice is no innocent in this world, just as well. Look how the innocent end. Used by the sin-sodden and the cynical, pulped to their purpose and ground under their heels. He hears Alice running upstairs. He hears her calling, Thomas, Thomas! It is a name that will bring half the house out, tumbling from their bedside prayers, from their very beds. Yes, are you looking for me? He pulls his furred gown around him and goes outside to look at the stars. The precincts of his house are kept well lit. The gardens by torchlight are the site of excavations. Trenches dug out for foundations, earth banked up into barrows and mounds. The vast timber frame of a new wing juts against the sky. In the middle distance, his new planting, a city orchard where Gregory one day will pick the fruit, and Alice and Alice's sons. He has fruit trees already, but he wants cherries and plums like the ones he has eaten abroad, and late pears to use in the Tuscan fashion, to match their crisp metallic flesh with winter salt cod. Then next year he means to make another garden at the hunting lodge he has at Canonbury, make it a retreat from the city, a summer house in the fields. He has work in hand at Stepney too, expansion. John Williamson is looking after the builders for him. Strange, but like a miracle, the family's prosperity seems to have cured him of his killing cough. I like John Williams, he thinks. Why ever did I, with his wife? Beyond the gate, cries and shouts. London never still or quiet. So many in the graveyards, but the living parading in the streets. Drunken fighters pitching from London Bridge. Sanctuary men stealing out to thieve. Southwark whores bawling out their prices like butchers selling dead flesh. He goes inside. His desk draws him back. In a small chest, he keeps his wife's book, her book of hours. Inside it are prayers on loose papers which he has inserted. Say the name of Christ 1,000 times, and it keeps fever away. But it doesn't, does it? The fever comes anyway and kills you. Beside the name of her first husband, Thomas Williams, she has written his own name. But she never, he notices, crossed Tom Williams out. She has recorded the births of her children, and he has written in beside them the dates of his daughters' deaths. He finds a space where he will note the marriages of his sister's children, Richard to Francis Murfin, Alice to his ward. He thinks, perhaps I have got over Liz. It didn't seem possible that weight would ever shift from inside his chest. But it has lightened enough to let him get on with his life. I could marry again, he thinks. But is this not what people are always telling me? He says to himself, I never think of Joanne Williamson now. Not Joanne she was for me. Her body once had special meaning, but that meaning is now unmade. The flesh created beneath his fingertips, hallowed by desire, becomes just the ordinary substance of a city wife, a fading woman with no particular looks. He says to himself, I never think of Anselma now. She's just the woman in the tapestry, the woman in the weave. He reaches for his pen. I have got over Liz, he says to himself. Surely. He hesitates, the quill in his hand, weighted by ink. He holds the pages down flat and strikes out the name of her first husband. He thinks, I've meant to do that for years. It is late. Upstairs he closes the shutter, where the moon gapes in a hollow-eyed, like a drunk lost in the street. Christoph, folding garments, says,
"Is there loo in this kingdom?"
"I think the wolves all died when the great forests were cut down. That howling you hear is only the Londoners." Sunday. In rose-tinted light, they set out from Austin Friars, his men in their new livery of grey marble cloth, collecting the party from the city house where the nun has been held. It would be convenient, he thinks, if I had Master Secretary's barge instead of making ad hoc arrangements when we have to cross the river. He has already heard Mass. Cranmer insists they all hear another. He watches the girl and sees her tears flow. Alice is right. She is at the end of her invention. By 9 o'clock, she's unwinding the threads she has spent years revelling up. She confesses in style, so hard and fast that rich can hardly keep track. And she appeals to them as men of the world, as people with their way to make. "You know how it is. You mention something and people are at you. And what do you mean? What do you mean? You say you've had a vision and they won't leave you alone." "You can't disappoint people," he says. She agrees, that's it, you can't. Once you start, you have to keep going. If you try to go back, they'll slaughter you. She confesses that her visions are inventions. She never spoke to heavenly persons, or raised the dead. That was all a fraud. She never had a hand in miracles. The letter from Mary Magdalene, Father Bocking wrote it, and the monk put gilding on the letters. In a minute she'll think of his name. The angels came out of her own invention. She seemed to see them, but she knows now they were just flashes of light against the wall. The voices she heard were not their voices. They were not distinct voices at all, just the sounds of her sister singing in the chapel, or a woman in the road crying because she's been beaten and robbed, or perhaps the meaningless clatter of dishes from the kitchen, and those groans and cries that seemed to come from the throats of the damned. It was someone above scraping a trestle across the floor. It was the whimper of a lost dog. "I know now, sirs, that those saints were not real, not in the way you are real." Something has broken inside her, and he wonders what that thing is. She says, "Is there any chance I could go home again to Kent?" "I'll see what can be arranged." Hugh Latimer is sitting with them, and he gives him a hard look, as if he's making false promises. "No, really," he says, "leave it with me." Cranmer tells her gently,
"Before you can go anywhere, it will be necessary for you to make public acknowledgement of your imposture, public confession."
"She's not shy of crowds, are you?" These many years she's been on the road, a travelling show, and will be again, though now the nature of the show has changed. He means to display her, repentant at Paul's Cross, and perhaps outside London too. He feels that she will take to the role of fraud with the same relish with which she took to her role as saint. He says to Rich, "Niccolo tells us unarmed prophets always fail." He smiles and says, "I mention this, Ricardo, because I know you like to have it by the book." Cranmer leans forward and says to the maid, "These men about you, Edward Bocking and the rest, which of them were your lovers?" She is shocked. Perhaps because the question has come from him, the sweetest of her interrogators. She just stares at him, as if one of them was stupid. He says, murmuring, "She may think lovers is not the word." Enough. To Audley, to Latimer, to Rich, he says, "I shall begin bringing in her followers and her leaders. She has ruined many, if we care to press for their ruin. Fisher, certainly. Margaret Pole, perhaps. Gertrude and her husband, for sure. Lady Mary, the king's daughter, quite possibly. Thomas More? No. Catherine? No. But a fat hall of Franciscans." The court rises, if court is what you call it. Jo stands up. She's been sewing, or rather unsewing, teasing out the pomegranate border from a cruel work panel. These remnants of Catherine of the dusty kingdom of Granada linger in England still. She folds her work, dropping her scissors into her pocket, pinching up her sleeve and feeding her needle into the fabric for later use. She walks up to the prisoner and puts a hand on her arm.
We must say adieu.
William Hawkehurst, the girl says.
I remember the name now. The monk who gilded the letter from Mary Magdalene.
Richard Rich makes a note.
Do not say any more today,
Joe advises.
Will you come with me, mistress, where I am going?
Nobody will come with you, Joe says.
I do not think you have the sense of it, Dame Eliza. You are going to the tower, and I am going home to my dinner.
This summer of 1533 has been a summer of cloudless days, of strawberry feasts in London gardens, the drone of fumbling bees, warm evenings to stroll under rose arbours, and hear from the alleys the sound of young gentlemen quarrelling over their bowls. The grain harvest is abundant even in the north. The trees are bowed under the weight of ripening fruit. As if he has decreed that the heat must continue, the king's court burns bright through the autumn. Monseigneur, the queen's father, shines like the sun, and around him spins a smaller but still blazing noonday planet, his son, George Rochford. But it is Brandon who leads the dancing, galloping through the halls, towing his new bride, whose age is 14. She is an heiress, and was betrothed to his son, but Charles thought an experienced man like him could turn her to better use. The Seymours have put their family scandal behind them, and their fortunes are mending. Jane Seymour says to him, looking at her feet,
Master Cromwell, my brother Edward smiled last week.
That was rash of him. What made him do so?
He heard his wife is sick. The wife he used to have. The one that my father, you know.
Is she likely to die?
Oh, very likely. Then he will get a new one. But he will keep her at his house in Elvetham, and never let her come within a mile of Wolf Hall. And when my father visits Elvetham, she will be locked in the linen room till he's gone again.
Jane's sister Lizzie's at court with her husband, the governor of Jersey, who is some connection of the new queen's. Lizzie comes packaged into her velvet and lace, her outlines, as firm as her sister's, are indefinite and blurred, her eyes bold and hazel and eloquent. Jane whispers in her wake. Her eyes are the colour of water, where her thoughts slip past like gilded fishes too small for hook or net. It is Jane Rochford, whose mind, in his view, is under-occupied, who sees him watching the sisters.
Lizzie Seymour must have a lover, she says. It cannot be her husband who puts that glow in her cheeks. He is an old man. He was old when he was in the Scots Wars.
The two sisters are just a little alike, she points out. They have the same habit of dipping their head and drawing in their underlip.
Otherwise, she says, smirking, you would think their mother had been up to the same tricks as her husband. She was a beauty in her day, you know, Marjorie Wentworth. And nobody knows what goes on down in Wiltshire.
I'm surprised you don't, Lady Rochford. You seem to know everyone's business.
You and me, we keep our eyes open. She lowers her head and says, as if directing the words inward to her own body, I could keep my eyes open, if you like, in places you cannot go.
Dear God, what does she want? It can't be money, surely. The question comes out colder than he means. Upon what possible inducement? She lifts her eyes to his.
I should like your friendship.
No conditions attached to that.
I thought I might help you, because your ally, Lady Carey, has gone down to Hever now to see her daughter. She's no longer wanted since Annie's back on duty in the bedchamber. Poor Mary, she laughs. God dealt her a good enough hand, but she never knew how to play it. Tell me, what will you do if the Queen does not have another child?
There is no reason to fear it. Her mother had a child a year. Boleyn used to complain it kept him poor.
Have you ever observed that when a man gets a son, he takes all the credit, and when he gets a daughter, he blames his wife? And if they do not breed at all, we say it is because her womb is barren. We do not say it is because his seed is bad.
It's the same in the Gospels. The stony ground gets the blame. The stony places, the thorny, unprofitable waste. Jane Rochford is childless after 7 years of marriage.
"I believe my husband wishes I would die,"
she says it lightly. He does not know how to answer. He has not asked for her confidence.
"If I do die," she says, in the same bright tone, "have my body opened. I ask you this in friendship. I am afraid of poison. My husband and his sister are closeted together for hours, and Anne knows all manner of poisons. She has boasted that she will give Mary a breakfast she will not recover from." He waits. "Mary, the king's daughter, I mean, though I am sure if it pleased Anne, she would not scruple to make way with her own sister." She glances up again.
"In your heart, if you are honest, you would like to know the things I know."
She is lonely, he thinks, and breeding a savage heart, like Leontina in her cage. She imagines everything is about her, every glance or secret conversation. She is afraid the other women pity her, and she hates to be pitied. He says, "What do you know of my heart?"
"I know where you have disposed it."
"It is more than I know myself."
"That is not uncommon among men. I can tell you who you love. Why do you not ask for her if you want her? The Seymours are not rich. They will sell you Jane, and be glad of the bargain."
"You are mistaken in the nature of my interest. I have young gentlemen in my house. I have wards. Their marriages are my business."
"Oh, fa-la-la," she says. "Sing another song. Tell it to infants in the nursery. Tell it to the House of Commons. You do most usually lie to them. But do not think you can deceive me."
"For a lady who offers friendship, you have rough manners."
"Get used to them, if you want my information. You go into Anne's rooms now, and what do you see? The Queen at her prie-dieu. The Queen sewing a smock for a beggar woman, wearing pearls the size of chickpeas."
It is hard not to smile. The portrait is exact. Anne has Cranmer entranced. He thinks her the pattern of pious womanhood.
"So, do you imagine that is what is really going on? Do you imagine she has given up communing with nimble young gentlemen? Riddles and verses and songs in praise of her? Do you suppose she has given them up?"
"She has the king to praise her.
Not a good word will she hear from that quarter till her belly is big again."
"And what will hinder that?"
"Nothing, if he's up to it."
"Be careful," he smiles.
"I never knew it was treason to say what passes in a prince's bed. All Europe talked about Catherine. What body part was put where? Was she penetrated? And if she was, did she know?" She sniggers. "Harry's leg pains him at night. He's afraid the Queen will kick him in the throes of her passion."
She puts her hand before her mouth, but the words creep out, narrow between her fingers.
"But if she lies still under him," he says, "what, madam, are you so little interested in making my heir?"
"I do not see what she is to do."
"She says she gets no pleasure with him, and he, as he fought 7 years to get her, he can hardly admit it as stale so soon. It was stale before they came from Calais. That's what I think."
"It's possible. Maybe they were battle-weary, exhausted. Yet he gives her such magnificent presents. And they quarrel so much. Would they quarrel so much if they were indifferent?"
"So," she goes on, "between the kicking and the sore leg, and his lack of prowess, and her lack of desire, it will be a wonder if we ever have a Prince of Wales. Oh, he is good man enough, if he had a new woman each week. If he craves novelty, who is to say she does not? Her own brother is in her service."
He turns to look at her. "God help you, Lady Rochford," he says.
"To fetch his friends her way, I mean. What do you think I meant?
A little grating laugh. Do you know what you mean yourself? You have been at court long enough. You know what games are played. It is no matter if any lady receives verses and compliments, even though she is married. She knows her husband writes verses elsewhere.
Oh, she knows that. At least I know. There is not a minx within 30 miles who has not had a set of Rochford's verses. But if you think the gallantry stops at the bedchamber's door, you are more innocent than I took you for. You may be in love with Seymour's daughter, but you need not emulate her in having the wit of a sheep.
He smiles. Sheep are maligned in that way. Shepherds say they can recognize each other. They answer to their names. They make friends for life.
And I will tell you who is in and out of everyone's bedchamber. It is that sneaking little boy, Mark. He is the go-between for them all. My husband pays him in pearl buttons and comfit boxes and feathers for his hat.
Why is Lord Rochford short of ready money?
You see an opportunity for usury.
How not? At least, he thinks, there is one point on which we concur. Pointless dislike of Mark. In Wolsey's house he had duties, teaching the choir children. Here he does nothing but stand about, wherever the court is, in greater or lesser proximity to the Queen's apartments. "Well, I can see no harm in the boy," he says.
"He sticks like a burr to his betters. He does not know his place. He is a jumped-up nobody, taking his chance because the times are disordered."
"I suppose you could say the same for me, Lady Rochford, and I'm sure you do." Thomas Wyatt brings him baskets of cobnuts and filberts, bushels of Kentish apples, jolting up himself to Austin Friars on the carrier's cart. "The venison follows," he says, jumping down. "I come with the fresh fruit, not the carcasses." His hair smells of apples, his clothes are dusty from the road. "Now you'll have words with me," he says, "for risking a doublet worth the carrier's yearly earnings." Wyatt looks chastened. "I forget you are my father." "I have rebuked you, so now we can fall to idle boyish talk." Standing in a wash of cherry autumn sun, he holds an apple in his hand. He pares it with a thin blade, and the peel whispers away from the flesh and lies among his papers, like the shadow of an apple, green on white paper and black ink. "Did you see Lady Carey when you were in the country?"
"Mary Boleyn in the country? What do you fresh pleasures spring to mind? I expect she's rutting in some hayloft."
"Just that I want to keep hold of her for the next time her sister is hors de combat." Wyatt sits down amid the files, an apple in his hand.
"Cromwell, suppose you'd been away from England for 7 years. If you'd been like a knight in a story lying under an enchantment, you would look around and wonder, who are they, these people?"
This summer, Wyatt vowed he would stay down in Kent. He would read and write on wet days, hunt when it is fine. But the fall comes, and the nights deepen, and Anne draws him back and back. His heart is true, he believes, and if she is false, it is difficult to pick where the falsehood lies. You cannot joke with Anne these days, you cannot laugh. You must think her perfect, or she will find some way to punish you. My old father talks about King Edward's days. He says, "You see now why it's not good for the king to marry a subject, an Englishwoman?" The trouble is, though Anne has remade the court, there are still people who knew her before, in the days when she came from France, when she set herself to seduce Harry Percy. They compete to tell stories of how she is not worthy, or not human, how she is a snake, or a swan. Una candida cerva. One single white doe, concealed in leaves of silver grey. Shivering, she hides in the trees, waiting for the lover who will turn her back from animal to goddess. "Send me back to Italy," Wyatt says. Her dark, her lustrous, her slanting eyes. She haunts me. She comes to me in my solitary bed at night. "Solitary? I don't think so."
Wyatt laughs.
"You're right. I take it where I can. You drink too much. Water your wine.
Could have been different.
Everything could.
You never think about the past?
I never talk about it.
Wyatt pleads. Send me away somewhere.
I will, when the king needs an ambassador.
Is it true that the Medici have offered for the Princess Mary's hand?
Not Princess Mary, you mean the Lady Mary. I've asked the king to think about it. But they're not grand enough for him. You know, if Gregory showed any interest in banking, I would look for a bride for him in Florence. It would be pleasant to have an Italian girl in the house.
Send me back there. Deploy me where I can be useful, to you or the king, as here I am useless and worse than useless to myself, and necessary to no one's pleasure.
He says, Oh, by the bleached bones of Becket, stop feeling sorry for yourself. Norfolk has his own view of the Queen's friends. He rattles a little while he expresses it, his relics clinking, his grey, disordered eyebrows working over wide-open eyes. These men, he says, these men who hang around with women. Norris, I thought better of him, and Henry Wyatt's son, writing verse, singing, talk, talk, talking. What's the use of talking to women? He asks earnestly. Cromwell, you don't talk to women, do you? I mean, what would be the topic? What would you find to say?
I'll speak to Norfolk, he decides when he comes back from France. Ask him to incline Anne to caution. The French are meeting the Pope in Marseille, and in default of his own attendance, Henry must be represented by his most senior peer. Gardiner is already there. For me, every day is like a holiday, he says to Tom Wyatt, when there's two away. Wyatt says, I think Henry may have a new interest by then. In the days following, he follows Henry's eyes as they rest on various ladies of the court. Nothing in them, perhaps, except the speculative interest of any man. It's only Cranmer who thinks that if you look twice at a woman, you have to marry her. He watches the king dancing with Lizzie Seymour, his hand lingering on her waist. He sees Anne watching, her expression cold, pinched. Next day, he lends Edward Seymour some money on very favourable terms. In the damp autumn mornings, when it is still half light, his household are out early in the damp and dripping woods. You don't get torta di funghi unless you pick the raw ingredients. Richard Rich arrives at 8 o'clock, his face astonished and alarmed. They stopped me at your gate, sir, and said, Where's your bag of mushrooms? No one comes in here without mushrooms. Richard's dignity is affronted. I don't think they would have asked the Lord Chancellor for mushrooms. Oh, they would, Richard. But in an hour you will eat them with eggs baked in cream, and the Lord Chancellor will not. Shall we get down to work? Through September, he has been rounding up the priests and monks who have been close to the maid. He and Sir Perse sift the papers and conduct the interrogations. The clerics are no sooner under lock and key than they begin to deny her and deny each other. I never believed in her. It was Father So-and-so who convinced me. I never wanted any trouble. As for their contacts with Exeter's wife, with Catherine, with Mary, each disclaims his own involvement and rushes to implicate his brother in Christ. The maid's people have been in constant contact with the Exeter household. She herself has been at many of the chief monastic houses of the realm. Sion Abbey, the Charterhouse at Sheen, the Franciscan house at Richmond. He knows this because he has many contacts among disaffected monks. In every house there are a few, and he seeks out the most intelligent. Catherine herself has not met the nun. Why should she? She has Fisher to act as a go-between, and Gertrude, Lord Exeter's wife. The king says, It is hard for me to believe Henry Courtenay would betray me. A garter knight, a great man in the lists, my friend since I was a boy. Wolsey tried to part us, but I wouldn't have it. He laughs. Brandon, do you remember Greenwich, that Christmas? Which year was it? Remember the snowball fight? This is the whole difficulty of dealing with them. Men who are always talking about ancient pedigrees, and boyhood friendships, and things that happened when he was still trading wool on the Antwerp Exchange. You put the evidence under their noses, and they start getting teary over snowball fights.
Look, Henry says, it is Courtney's wife that is to blame. When he knows the whole of her practices, he will want to be rid of her. She is fickle and weak like all her sex, easily led into scheming.
So forgive her, he says.